Hello, I'm Greg Johnston, and welcome to Imagining the Past. This series of podcasts were culled from sessions held during the 2019 Historical Novel Society Australasia Conference, held at the Parramatta campus of Western Sydney University on the 26th and 27th of October, 2019. The podcasts were made from live microphone feeds. This session is the first podcast of our personal history sessions, in conversation with Nicole Alexander and Ella Carey. Nicole Alexander writes sweeping epics invoking the grandeur of Australian landscapes, the hardships of rural life, and the turmoil of historic events. Ella Carey introduces her readers to quiet interconnections through parallel narratives of women living in modern and past times. Both authors draw on their personal histories to weave tales into the wider historical context. Irina Dunn asks these authors about their writing journeys, the inspiration for their books, and why they draw upon family legend.
Well, you cannot imagine how delighted I am to be sitting here with these two amazingly accomplished, talented and well-educated women. It's a real great pleasure to be here to be able to quiz you about your work. I thought that it would be possibly because none of you has read either of our panellists' latest novel. I thought it would be a really good idea if I asked them just to read a piece, short piece from their novels to give you an idea of the writing, and then we can go kick off the discussion from that. Is that okay with the two of you? Mm-hmm. Okay, Nicole, how about
starting? Do you want to start off with a sort of like a snapshot of what the stories are about? Or just launch straight into it?
Yes, launch straight into give it. Us it. And I'm prepared to take suggestions from panellists. So, yes, tell us what the story's about.
Okay, so Stone Country spans the period 1901 to 1940 and follows the life of Ross Grant, who's the second of two boys born into a wealthy Scottish family in Adelaide in South Australia. When the Great War breaks out, their father decides that it's the eldest boy, Alistair, who should enlist because he believes that his favourite son will acquit himself far better on the field of battle. A couple of years into the war, however, and Alistair goes missing and is eventually branded a deserter. Now, the Grant family are dismayed by their boy's lack of honour, and in an effort to restore the Grant family's reputation amongst Adelaide society, they coerce the younger brother, Ross, into marrying Alistair's fiancée, Darcy. Now, this he does do, very reluctantly, but it's on the condition that he can fulfil one of his own ambitions, and that's to basically go north to the territory where his father, who is a land speculator, has purchased a cattle property sight unseen.
Thanks for that. Ella, give us a synopsis of your latest novel, Beyond the Horizon.
So my novel is inspired by the women's Air Force service pilots who flew in America during World War II. Between 1942 and 1944, they flew 60 million miles for their country, flew every type of plane that the Air Force flew, and at the end of 1944, we were completely disbanded and sent home with no recognition, no acknowledgement. 38 of them had died while flying during the war. So, and I'll probably talk a little bit more later about the personal inspiration for this story and the research I carried out, but the basic premise is my character, Eva, was a women's Air Force service pilot. In 1977, the Air Force in America announced they were training women to be pilots for the first time. So, of course, these Air Force service pilots fought Congress and said, no, look, we flew too. So my book dovetails between 1977 and the period of time when these women were training out in Sweetwater in Texas and then flying. And so I'm going to read a little bit about when Eva, who is a girl from Burbank in California, first arrived at Sweetwater in Texas to this training facility to fly. And in 1977, she cannot remember the details of a terrible accident that killed one of her friends and co-pilots and subsequently cut her off from all her friends with whom she trained. They just have not contacted her for 30 years. She doesn't know. She's got PTSD. So this little part is back in 1943 when she first arrives.
Excellent. Now we'll go to Nicole's reading.
Okay. So Ross is now up in the Territory and he's had a number of major tragedies that have occurred for him personally, and he basically has had enough with the people around him, so he goes walkabout. Not much pushed Ross onwards other than rage. He and Nugget travelled west and south, paddled up rivers, walked rangy hills and skirted the Tanami Desert. 8 years had passed. Sorry, that's the red wine from last night. 8 years had passed, and in that time he'd sunk bores on the Barkly, tracked wild horses, and constructed so many fences in the south that he hazarded Australia was now cut in half. Miles and miles of boundary lines constructed for big-hatted men with lofty ideals, such as those he'd once dreamed. With each post that split the earth, with each swing of the mallet, Ross killed off a little more of his life, hammering the past into the ground. When he stopped and thought of the broken world left behind, he'd step over the pile of cut poles waiting to be bedded and move on. He considered returning to Waybell Station, to the place of lost women, but hard labour became so ingrained in the hours that stretched out between dawn and the evening star that Ross now doubted he'd ever feel whole without the thrust of exhaustion and the uncertainty of what lay ahead. He sensed defeat in the prospect of going back, and he speculated that life was better alone, that it would get better, and if not, he could exist with what he had. At last he was an explorer of lands already settled and tamed, of his own ability to survive. He rode with Afghan cameleers, led pack mules loaded with mail to red-crusted stations that treated him like a dignitary, and went far enough south for white dots to reveal the sheep of his younger years. Ross had arrived at the Mount Wells tin mine nearly a year ago. He'd taken a dog leg west to avoid Pine Creek, and the mine was simply in his path when he came back from the south. The Chinese miners weren't partial to his arrival. They may have been working for a company, however, with their kind having laid claim to the site some 40 years earlier. They'd dug, died and gone mad, chasing the vein that dipped deep beneath the valley, and they weren't inclined towards any outsiders entering their domain. There were few white men labouring here. Conditions were rough and the fever claimed many. Ross remained because the desire to move had been beaten out of him for a while, and when he considered leaving, there was really no fixed place he could think of to go. Unused to the business of keeping his thoughts hidden and his fists by his side, the first few months were painful and difficult. What struck him most were the people. There were too many of them, living in tents and small timber structures. It was like entering a city where some streets were safe and others not, but it was their city, where they wielded pickaxes by day and chattered at night, carried lumps of rock from the bowels of the earth and scooped up rice with their fingers. There was little choice for Ross. Either he got along with these men or got out. So he got along with them, and by the time of his leaving, just prior to the wet and 10 pounds lighter in weight, Ross had a higher regard for them than on his arrival. Don Hart was a teamster whose job was to haul supplies to and from the site. The boy, 16 years of age and thin and scraggly like a yard of pump water, nearly ran Ross over with a dray the first time they met. The second time, the boy bashed one of the workers over the head when he came across Ross and the man rolling around in the dirt. "What was that about?" Hart asked as the attacker ran away. "A book," Ross panted, wiping the blood from his chin. He held up the last of Alistair's novels. "It's called The 12 Labours of Hercules," he explained. "Don't look like there's much reading left in it," the boy commented. "And you don't look like you'd be much of a reader." The book was dog-eared and missing a whole wedge of pages. "It's the only thing I've got left." Ross stuffed the book inside his shirt. "Well then, You better hang on to it, the boy replied. Ross thought on those kindly words. Hart spoke as if he understood what it was to lose something dear. The boy was a curiosity. He had the eyes of an old man and was friendly to all, although he was no skilled driver. If there was a will to be broken, Hart's navigation managed to find every rock and stump. Ross suggested the boy leave before Ping, the Chinese overseer, killed him and fed him to the pigs for the damage he'd caused. There were a few graves about, but not the number to match the deaths he'd heard about, and fresh pork fetched a good price.
Oh, wonderful. Wonderful writing. Thank you. I do have to tell you something that Lisa didn't do, but I'm luckily able to do. Some of the reviews that Nicole got for this book, including from Time Australia, elegantly written and emotionally haunting. Well, I think you got that idea from the piece that she read out. And pardon me, my throat has gone from last night as well. The Courier Mail. The Courier Mail, for goodness sake, writes, Alexander writes from first-hand experience of the harshness of bush life as well as a deep love of the land. And, oh, look, I just have to share this with you if you hadn't looked at a book. I just love this photo of Nicole. Look at her. She's there in her jeans. She's got one hand in her pocket. She's got a broad hat on and she looks just fantastic. There's the intellectual grazier. Par excellence. Woman's Day says it was wonderfully researched and beautifully written indeed. And Better Reading says Stone Country is a gripping emotional journey set against the Australian landscape so vivid and visceral that you feel as if you are there. So congratulations for all those wonderful reviews. Ella, please, that's you.
Thanks. Ella.
They travelled for half an hour, the hot wind blowing hard against either side of the truck, the rattling engine too loud for them to talk. Eva watched the old cotton fields with one eye open, and she counted at least five oil wells on the way to Avenger Field. Finally, Rebecca turned off the main road to a slip road, passing a couple of hangars in the middle of nowhere. Once they got past them, an airfield spread out, and Eva sat up, shading her eyes with her hands. Just look at that. Rebecca pulled up with a jolt and came around to open the truck. That's my job done for the day. Welcome to Avenger Field. Thank you, ma'am. Eva, suddenly wide awake, was down on the ground before Nina had stood up. Dry red dust swirled up around her legs, forming a film that coated the air. A barbed wire fence ran the length of the road. And Eva wondered, was that to keep people out or to keep the girls in? On the airfield behind it sat over 100 planes. Eva took a long look at them. Behind her, the sounds of Nina saying her farewells to Rebecca were lost in the excitement of the sight in front of her. They were all there. Little primary trainers, the PT-19As, basic training planes, the BT-13 Volte vibrators, and finally advanced training AT-6s. Eva made out groups of AT-17s with their Cessna twin engines. The planes twinkled in the harsh sunlight. 22 weeks surrounded by aeroplanes. Suddenly, she wished she could share this sight with Harry, because painful crush or no crush, her heart swelled with the excitement and the possibilities out here. Nina was by her side, staring out at it. The sound of Rebecca thundering away in the cattle truck rang into the quiet air. "Well, will you look at that?" Nina whistled low. A little farther up the road, there was an entrance, and two girls stood at the gate. "Think we best haul ourselves up that way, given we're the last arrivals and all." Eva motioned to Nina, "Let's go. We'll get to see plenty of these babies over the next few months." Nina trudged along next to her. Once they got to the gate, Eva stopped for a moment. A sassy-looking gremlin was painted over the entry. She wore a red top, yellow pants, and a pair of flying goggles, and on her back, she had a pair of little wings. She looked like she was airborne, and Eva couldn't help the giggle that rose in her throat. "Well now, welcome you two." A tall girl with neatly pulled back auburn hair stepped forward and held out a hand. She looked immaculate and freshly washed, and as if she dealt with 100-degree heat every day of her life. "Welcome to your new home. I see you've spotted our mascot, Fifinella." The girl pointed up at the sign. "She's our protector, a nice flying gremlin. Fifi welcomes everyone who attends Avenger Field with a smile on her face." The girl waited while Eva and Nina took in Fifinella. "I'm Helena. I'm Eva Scott, and this is my friend Nina Rogers." Nina stepped forward to shake the much taller girl's hand. "Charmed to meet you, Helena." Helena scanned a list that she held. "They gave me the task of welcoming the girls to our class. It's something I can do, organise folks." She pulled out a silver pen, a frown creasing her milky smooth features, and placed a couple of neat ticks on her list. Nina caught Eva's eye and raised a brow. "We've been on that train for days on end," Nina said. "I hardly know up from down, and yet I can tell you, the sight of those planes makes me feel like I've arrived home at last. But you look like you're as cool as the sea in summer." "You've come from California," Helena asked, looking up from their names on the paper. "No wonder you're exhausted." "All the way from LA," Eva said. The other girl standing next to Helena stepped forward. "This is Nancy." Helena had a well-modulated voice that sounded like it came from the East Coast, from one of Boston or New York's finest schools. They'd come prepared to meet all sorts of girls, and it seemed that the group would not disappoint. "You desert girls are always swell. Welcome to Avenger Field." Nancy was medium height with bright red hair, and her face was covered with a spatter of freckles. "I hail from Cincinnati, and Helena here comes from New York or Boston," Eva couldn't resist. "Technically speaking, Los Angeles is no desert." Nina let out a laugh. "Boston," Helena said, her eyes dancing from Eva to Nina. "But our friend Nancy here is much more interesting than me. She's a fully trained scientist. She loves to look at the stars. I'm afraid she's a lot smarter than me too. Her brains are going to put me to shame. But like I say, I can organise folks, so that's what I'm going to do, whether you like it or not." Nancy threw back her head and let out a loud laugh. "Oh, don't you be ridiculous, Helena. I'll tell you one of the reasons I had to apply for WASP, because Texas here is one of the best places on this planet to look at stars. The night skies are huge and endless out here. Can't wait to get up in the air and fly in the dark. I tell you, it's going to be magical. Just you wait, girls."
Oh, wonderful.
And, pardon me, so Beyond the Horizon was rated 4.67 out of 5 stars on Goodreads, as you probably know, Ella, and Linda's book obsession review of Beyond the Horizon stated, "I highly recommend this thought-provoking novel for readers who appreciate historical fiction." So this session is about personal histories and how personal histories are incorporated into historical fiction. So let me ask you, Nicole, have you always used a personal history in your fiction, and when did you start?
So I started writing probably about, 25 years ago. So I did travel articles, short stories, poetry, a whole heap of different stuff, wrote for some newspapers. And then I decided to write a novel. And my family's been in the bush since 1893. So we have quite a wealth of archival materials, yeah. Everything from paddock books and station diaries and mail order catalogues through to this sort of a lot of oral history that's been passed down through the generations as well. So when I started thinking about crafting my first novel, I thought, wow, you know, my background's the bush. Made sense, you know, people tell a first-time author, write about what you know if possible. So I decided to incorporate some of that information into my first novel. And ever since then, where possible, depending on the era that I'm writing about and the plot, obviously, I tend to sort of go back to that archival pile and literally search through it and see what I can find to use in a story.
So you had a really rich store of personal material, and you didn't have to travel far to discover that. It was all there waiting for you to mine it.
Well, pretty much. I guess the benefit of it is that it's primary source material. So then after that I was going reading, obviously, fiction and non-fiction written in and of the period that I was writing about, and then obviously searching further afield. I'm a big fan of reading family histories and regional histories, etc., to get a really good grasp of a particular area I'm writing about, because I do tend to concentrate mainly on Australian history. So, yeah, so I've been very fortunate in that I do have that information.
Yes.
And these stories as well, of course, you know, Bush families love a good story.
Indeed. Yeah. Well, I'm going to ask you about those stories. Ella, you have a particular connection with flying in your family, don't you?
Yes, so when my mother finished school, the war broke out. I'm kind of a generation out. I have much older brothers and sisters. And we had finished school, the war broke out, so instead of going to university, she joined the Women's Australian Auxiliary Air Force and was stationed up in Malala. And I don't know if any of you know South Australia well, but living in a hut in Malala, which is this kind of north of Adelaide, flat landscape on an Air Force training base where male pilots came in for 4 years, was just, I mean, such a shaping experience for her. But she died several years ago and never really talked about it. And like Lisa was saying yesterday, all she really talked about was the camaraderie between these women who were together and how great it was. And there was never any complaining, not a word of that at all. So this incredibly resilient generation. But there was this one friendship that she had that ended badly because she joined up with this particular one friend who then left to get married halfway through the war. And my mother was this lovely woman, but she never spoke to this friend again. That was it. And that always intrigued me because she kind of left the girls, you know. Yeah. And then when I was at the Historical Novelist Society, there's a lovely chapter in Melbourne, and I was talking about Secret Shores. I told this story about my mother and this friend. Somehow we came across it, up to it, and in question time, all these people said, why? What happened? You know, why would she, you know, what was, and then there was this whole, then the next question was, do you think that, you know, somehow the friend's fiancé made a move on your mum or what, you know, what, and I thought, okay. There's a novel here, and this gives me an opportunity to learn more about perhaps what my mother went through. And then my agent said, look at the Wasp in America, because they actually flew and women in Australia weren't allowed to fly. So that set it off.
Mm, very interesting. You know, personal histories can actually be very messy and they don't necessarily fit into the strictures of fiction. I know that from people who are trying to write memoirs and put it into a novel, and they always want to mention every single last detail from their personal history, and it just does not fit the storyline. So did you find that you were facing these sorts of questions when you were writing your fictions?
Well, I usually only look at sort of one small area, something I can use for my own family history. So it could be a story, it could be an article I've read, it could be a note that perhaps my great-grandfather wrote down in a diary or something like that, and then I see if I can incorporate it into a novel. So with Stone Country, I had this idea of these two boys, you know, one going to war and one's being forced, literally forced to stay at home. And that was based on my own paternal grandfather's experiences. So in 1916, when all those dreadful casualty reports started coming in from the Somme, my grandfather decided that he would be the one to enlist and fight abroad, while his younger brother would stay at home and look after the property and their mother. Their father had passed on earlier in 1903. And when I thought about that, I thought, well, that seems quite logical, you know, this apportioning of responsibilities. Yes. One boy does his duty abroad, the other one stays at home, looks after the mother and the property, and is actually contributing to the war effort through the production of wool, because it was a sheep property, obviously for the manufacture of uniforms. But then you take a step further back. So 1916, towards the end of that year, that's the period when white feathers began to be handed out. Mm. For cowards in Australia. So I'd imagine that from my great uncle's point of view, he would have felt there's this enormous, obviously, concern for a beloved older brother that may or may not come back from the front, but also at the same time, huge guilt because he wasn't doing his bit and men were dying abroad. Now, there's no record in our archives to suggest that he actually was the recipient of one of those white feathers, but I've got no doubt he would have received some fairly derogatory comments, whether they were said jokingly or not. So when it came to crafting Stone Country, I was very aware of what had happened in my own family. So I had to look at what it was like for the boy who stayed at home, feeling this enormous guilt because he wasn't abroad with his brother. And in Ross's case, there's an added element because he starts to think during his lifetime when his older brother goes missing and then is accused of being a deserter, a coward, what if he'd been allowed to go as well? What if he'd been with Alistair? Maybe his brother would have come home. Now, the repercussions for those men who, some who went, obviously, fought overseas, are totally different to those who stayed at home. There's major accounts of men dying early, becoming alcoholics, because of the guilt that they felt from not serving. My grandfather came back a decorated war hero. My great uncle died early, an alcoholic.
And would probably, no doubt, have been suffering his own form of PTSD as a result of his...
Absolutely, yes. Because he felt so guilty.
Yes.
Yeah.
Emma, how did your fiction fill in the missing gaps in your personal history?
So I think for me, writing, it does need to be very personal, and I need to feel that emotive connection to my work. So that was where it was wonderful to be able to intertwine my mother's story with the research I'd done. And so I went to Texas and I visited the training site where these women trained. And the whole time I was looking for those connections with the personal story that I had. Because when I'm writing, I need to almost have that emotive feel. It almost needs to grab me in the gut while I'm writing. Otherwise, I don't think it's working because writing is such an emotive art form. Fiction is an emotive art form. So I was interviewing the director of the WASMAP Museum there, who was just amazing and ended up driving me all the way back to Dallas because she said, you cannot get on a Greyhound bus and go all the way back. And took me out for dinner. We just talked for 48 hours straight. And I said to her, what would happen? Have you seen any instances of women who left the WASP during the training process, or do you know of any of this? And she looked at me and she said, absolutely. That was a thing amongst these women. And they have reunions every year. And there was this woman who'd come back and she'd absconded. She'd left during the war. And all the other women were like, she shouldn't be here. We don't want to know about this. She left. So it was really interesting. And that, I think, part of this novel was about female friendship. And I find it really interesting that I think young women form quite intense female friendships. I mean, we always do. But at that early age, perhaps as a precursor to that romantic relationship or the relationship you might have with your partner, they form these quite intense connections with each other. And so it was at this age, it was a potboiler. They were all together. Yes. They were cut from their lives and made to go to the war and thrust together. So you can imagine what must have gone on. Yes. And so it was trying to make that connection, learn a little bit more about what my mother might have gone through. And so I was pushing that way the whole time. And then, 156 drafts of the book and we got there.
Well, that's a question I want to ask you later as well. There was something really interesting that was said yesterday in the session on Jackie French that some of you may have been there. Jackie French said something wonderful. She said, many true stories put together make another story. I think that's just... you know, fantastic. Was that I think that's the experience that both of you had in your writing. But, you know, you both produced so many novels. You produced 9, you produced only 6. You're a slack girl. did you start using personal history right from the get-go, or were you very concerned to produce a work of fiction that was entirely fiction? Ella, I'll ask you first this one.
I was probably more concerned with producing a work of fiction. So, but for me, that personal thread wove through the novel and allowed me to explore questions that I had that I wanted to know more about that were missing in my own personal history, if that makes sense. But yes, the work is entirely fictional and I'm very careful to do that. I think that in terms of representing true people or people that have existed in the past or family members or people who might have inspired parts of a character, it's about respect. So I'm very careful, particularly writing historical fiction, mindful that our relatives are still alive and that descendants are still around. So I read a lot of personal histories of these women pilots. Part of my research was the director of the museum took me to the Women's University in Texas, and they have a huge archive collection about the WASP. So I was able to read diaries, memoirs, letters home, that sort of thing. And I was just engulfed with all these personal stories, which were fabulous. I mean, there is one in the book where Rita is actually one of my characters, is about to go and have her vaccinations, and she's got this beautiful big pair of Texan boots she's bought, and she fainted in them before she was given her shots, and that did happen. I thought that is just gorgeous. And then someone said, look, she's gone and died with her Texan boots on. And there were a few little things like that that I couldn't help. And then one instance of a pilot taking off one of the WASP, and she clipped the high tension telegraph wire, and then all the lights went off in the base, and so the girls were flying in quadrants up above this with nothing in the dark, and all the radios were lost. So one of the women's accounts was, you know, do I just end this? Do I just crash this plane? I can't. She was freaking out. Mm-hmm. So a lot of that informed it, but yes, you're right. You have to, it's fiction, and so you're overwhelmed by all this research and these fabulous stories, and you have to then make up your own story. So yes, there's a real tension there, but I was determined to make up my own story, and that's when your characters start taking over and that's flowing. So that's a good question. It's getting to that point.
Nicole, I want to ask you if writing any of your personal histories has ever got you into trouble with anybody.
Interesting question. My first book, we had the launch in Goondiwindi in Queensland at the Royal Hotel. And there were about, 110 people there. And I got up and talked a little bit about the book. And nearly everyone had read it. And they took the view that, because even though it was fiction, that because the story was about four generations of a grazing family, that obviously I'd written about my own family. So at the end of my little talk, and we had the question time, where everyone had been having a few drinks, as you can imagine as well, someone stood up, and my family was there, including my father, someone stood up and said, my question's not for you, Nicole, it's for your dad. Ian, I didn't realise that you built your business on stock theft. It was a male.
A male asked the question.
Right, so we're talking, the story starts back, my family's been in the bush since 1893. This particular story starts around the 1860s. So it was a good, 30 or 40 years prior. But this guy was convinced that that's how we started the business, stock theft. And it took a number of phone calls, because Dad was really concerned about it, obviously, to actually set him right that it wasn't. That, just because I use the sort of the basis of my family history didn't mean that it was all fact in the middle. So, yes, sometimes, people go to a work with their own, their backgrounds, likes and dislikes, preconceived ideas about how a story or people or characters should react in any given work that they're reading. And they impose those values on your work, regardless of whether you obviously, you have no control over that. So that was a really interesting example.
Yes.
But of course I was a new novelist, it was my first book, and I'm a bush author, so it was a novelty for everybody as well. That's the worst case.
There are not many fourth generation graziers who are also prize winning novelists.
Are there?
No, I guess not.
Well, that was really a rhetorical question. So I want to ask you both, has the way you're using personal histories, and I use that in the broader sense, changed over the course of all the novels that you've written? Can I start with you, Ella, on this one? Is there a difference that you notice in the way you're treating material, or...
I think all fiction is autobiographical. I think that it's impossible to disconnect yourself from your work. And I think at some level it comes out. The personal does come out. I think, yeah, it has changed. My first three novels were more based on my love of Paris and France and this beautiful mystery about this abandoned apartment in Paris. I think I was writing at a deeper level about, again, the war, because there was a lot of silence that had come out in the kind of generations in those books, and that was me tapping into this, my parents' experiences during the war and the fact that they didn't speak about it. So at a deeper level, that's what I was writing about. And I think as I was writing those novels, I would look back and I would have written a draft and I'll be thinking, oh, that's why I've written that. I'm exploring something more personal. Then with coming up to Old Secret Shores was definitely informed by a family connection to the oldest merino sheep stud in Australia, to Annalaby, and I went out there and stayed with the current owners, who were just amazing, and... That was fascinating and allowed me to explore a bit more of a personal history. Then The Things We Don't Say was informed by the Bloomsbury Group. And so for me that was about the writing and about art and Vanessa Bell and Virginia Woolf and wanting to explore the nature of art and artists. So I think that was probably a little bit more introspective. This one definitely inspired by my mother, and the next one... I don't know. The next one's actually probably more personal at another level. So it's kind of ebbs and waves. The story comes first, so, and the characters, and then I had it's exactly like what Jackie said yesterday. It's this voracious need to explore. You need to have that complete passion for the topic, and so it has changed over time. Yes, definitely, and I guess it'll just continue to keep going. By what sparks my interest, without an informed decision every time that this is what I want to explore.
Yes. Oh, well, so it's more of an organic.
Yeah, very organic.
Yes. Nicole, have you noticed a change in the way that you treat personal histories over the course of your only nine novels?
I think what I've started to do now is, initially I was relying a lot on my own family's history and probably not reading a lot further afield, because I knew, my specialty is really sort of like from 1900s to 1950s Australian pastoral history. So I guess I sort of already have that in my head anyways. Going forward, since those initial couple of first books, I have started to research a lot more, because one, I've been writing in different eras as well, so I don't necessarily have the information at hand from my own family's archives, and I'm really enjoying getting out as far as the research components are concerned as well, with field trips to these different areas I'm writing about. So my early novels really concentrated on New South Wales and Queensland, because I know the country and I was very well aware of it. Stone Country, however, is set in South Australia and the Northern Territory. So I spent time researching in Adelaide, the mid-north of the state, Burra, and then obviously up into the Northern Territory. So Darwin, a week camping out in my swag with a guide in Kakadu National Park in December. Very hot, wouldn't recommend it at that time of year. Yeah, it's just extraordinary. So I think that's how it's changed for me. I'm still using personal history where I can in my novels, but I'm certainly supplementing it a lot more with this research, and particularly field research. And the thing is, as well, is that I'm still learning. I'm hopefully growing as a writer. So I want to push myself and get out into the field and see and experience different things too, to make the work a lot richer. I'm a great lover of the Australian landscape. It's only the background to a story, but it literally is the tapestry the words are unfolding upon. So I really want to get out and see and feel an environment so that when you open the page, you can see and feel and hear what I've experienced as well during one of those research trips. So I think that's the main way my books have changed, particularly with the last four.
I hope you've enjoyed this discussion. If you would like to know more about the Historical Novel Society Australasia and our numerous activities to promote reading and writing historical fiction, please visit our website www.hnsa.org.au. There you'll also find full biographies of our podcast participants under the tab News and Interviews. I'm Greg Johnston, and thank you for listening to this podcast.